You are listening to the Ivy Podcast. Learn from the thought leaders in areas of strategy, innovation, negotiation, and all things leadership. We interview the Ivy League, Fortune 100, and top startups. Now, here's your host, John Karsibayev.
My guest for this episode is Lulu Curiel, the founder and president of Ivy Advisors, a Silicon Valley admissions consulting firm that helps ambitious professionals land in the most competitive MBA programs in the world, such as the Harvard Business School, Stanford GSB, MIT Sloan, Wharton Booth, Kellogg, and many others. Under Lulu's leadership, Ivy Advisors has launched the Ivy Fellows Program, a social impact initiative that provides Latinas with GMAT classes, personalized coaching, and the community support required to gain admissions in top-ranked business schools and high-impact career paths. Lulu, welcome to the Ivy Podcast. So excited to have you.
Thank you, Jan. It's very excited to be here with you.
Awesome. So, Lulu, if you don't mind, please tell us more about the Ivy Advisors. How did the company idea get conceived? And more specifically, what is your role within the company?
Sure. So I attended business school in the start of 2008, which you might remember it was the economic recession. I was lucky enough that I was admitted to the Harvard Business School, and you know, I had a safety net for 2 years. But around the same time, some of my friends approached me because the economy was bad. They wanted to go back to school and somehow find new jobs. And they were asking me, how did you do that? And I found myself helping a lot of people, friends and friends of friends and their relatives and so on. And then, you know, being business school, I guess, you start thinking about how do I monetize this opportunity? How do I scale it? How do I make it larger? And that's how Ivy Advisors was born. That said, after graduation, I did take a full-time job with Apple. I wasn't ready to do this full-time. I was still proving the concept, taking a few people, understanding, you know, what kind of clients I enjoyed working with or not. And with more time, I gained the confidence to take it on full-time. My role is that I'm the president of the company. I run the company. I recruit our advisors, our MBA coaches. I recruit and train our GMAT instructors. And I also lead the sales effort. There are coaches, wonderful coaches on our team who are the ones interfacing with the clients, and they're the ones preparing our clients to enter the Ivy League schools. I myself, with time, have narrowed down my pool of mentees and coaches, I guess, to a limited number because I have to run the whole company.
Well, that's great. Thank you for sharing that story, and it sounds very interesting how you first started out as, you know, almost as a hobby or as a way to help your friends. And it's great to see that actually translate and going into an actual company. Thank you for sharing that. So to follow up on what you were just talking about, so what are some, obviously the application process, especially to the Ivy League school or any other top tier programs, is very difficult. There's a lot involved. So what are some of the biggest challenges that you help overcome to your applicants?
Yeah, some of the biggest challenges and what fascinates me the most about this line of work is helping people believe in themselves. You know, you have a population of applicants who are confident in their own right, and they're overachievers, they have great jobs and whatnot, and you know they're going to get into one of these Ivy League schools, they just need somebody to project management. That's just set. That's one population. But the more interesting population of applicants are those who are wonderful. They bring great talent. They have a great potential. And once you just engage with them in a conversation, you can discover they're so mature and so so honest and humble to the point that their humility is interfering with their sense of confidence. So some of the challenges are more interpersonal. Like it's that making them believe in themselves and making sure that they're not the worst enemy in the sense that they're not filtering information. That they open up and tell you, hey, I did this. It was a small project. It sounds insignificant, but this is what I achieved. Or some of them are, this is my background. You know, I had one guy who talked about, just as a side note, not even part of his essay or whatnot, he was just telling me about his personal experience. He was in a court hearing. He was on the witness stand and how he was talking about his father and how his conversation persuaded the judge to rule a certain outcome that helped his family. And I'm like, that's powerful. Why are you talking about that? And they don't have confidence in tapping into those special moments in their life. And the biggest challenge is just going through that discovery phase with them and then making them see that they are good enough. They should be confident enough and building that momentum so that they can apply to the Ivy League school and ultimately get in.
Well, that's very interesting. Thank you for sharing, especially that example. A lot of times you don't even think about, examples like that. That's something that will definitely help you to get into some of the best schools. That's very interesting. Can you share with us some of the use cases or the actual examples where one of the applicants with the IDV advisors did not get accepted to a school of choice? And what did you learn from that particular experience?
Mm-hmm. Got it. We do have some people who get into their safety school and not their top choice. I would like to separate the population. There's a pool of people who are super aggressive when they think about MBA programs. That means that they want to get into a top-ranked MBA program, maybe the top one or top five, not even the top three. They just want to get into either Harvard Business School or Stanford GSB. And if they don't get in, they'd rather not go. So there's that population. And when you make a bet like that one, it's highly aggressive. Because Harvard Business School admissions rate is about 14%, and the Stanford GSB admissions rate is about 7%. Just numbers alone, they're not working in your favor. And we have applicants who say, I'll only go to one of those two. And when that happens, there's a chance they don't get A. And the learning there isn't as deep as the other, which I'll go into. They just know, okay, I tried my best. I'm at peace knowing. As an example, there's a Google employee who was working in the sales group, and you know he had stellar credentials, great track record, great recommendations, and his bet was on those two schools. But he didn't get in, and he was very happy about the outcome because he tried everything he could. It didn't work out, but the backup choice, which is just staying at Google in this great role at sales, wasn't that bad either, but he tried it. So that one is a more, an easier path, I would say, just a try, right? But for others, sometimes people, it's facing somewhat of denials. people don't come with the best credentials. Or they just want to aspire for more, which we do encourage. We encourage people to aspire. And in the particular case, I can think of one who, you know, the stats were not in his favor, especially because he had some problems with the law. And that was in his record. And our work was helping him realize, hey, this is going to be difficult. You have to open up and own what happened. And sometimes that happens when the candidate, they don't want to listen to their coach. There's a sense of denial and saying, no, this is not relevant enough. I will not bring it up, or I do not want to explain that. And that's difficult. And of course, they don't get in because they couldn't explain that moment in their life. And the schools need to understand that in order to know you've moved on, you've grown, you will not make the same mistake again. So what we learn from that experience as coaches is that no matter how much we coach, the decision relies on the applicant, on that candidate. They have the free will and they will exercise it. And at the end of the day, they own their destiny. They are accountable for that destiny. from their end, it's a humble moment. They realize it almost too late, and it's a humble moment for them to be, okay, I get it. I didn't own that moment, but I'm going to my backup school anyway because I just want to go to a school. There are others who don't get in the first time. They don't put in the same effort, a lot of effort, but they apply the second time, but it's just an effort. They didn't dedicate enough time. They try the second time, they get in. Those are easier. The learning is just that. You just got to work hard and really own the application process. So, you know, everybody has a different learning. At the end of the day, it's about taking ownership of your destiny.
So to get a little bit deeper into what you had just explained, how selective are you with your applicants, or do you try to work with everyone at least at the beginning? I'm curious about what is the criteria that you guys use to decide on who to work with? How do you guys select?
Great. That's a great question. We get asked that a lot by our clients as well. So we have a rule, which is do no harm in taking a client. That means a number of things. If you're taking a client, it means, first of all, you have the bandwidth as a coach to take on that extra client and not dilute the experience for anybody else that you're already working with. So that's one. Also, do no harm in terms of expectations. We're selective in the sense that we have to make sure whoever works with us comes in with the right expectation. We're very blunt and direct in telling them, hey, based on everything you're given, we think this is a great stretch goal for you. Let's go for that, and we encourage you to. But we want to be realistic about the probability, the chances that you're getting, and, you know, want to have a conversation about the safety net or not. To my previous point of some people don't want a safety net. So do no harm in terms of bandwidth and in terms of expectation. And once they meet that, that's just, and then it comes, there's a personal screening that we each have as coaches. And that's just people who are nice human beings, a no-jerk policy almost. You can imagine some people hire us to feel entitled because they're paying us, they feel entitled to treat us in a certain way, and we just prefer to not work with them. Some of them are just wonderful human beings. It's a professional relationship. There's diplomacy in the relationship.
I love that. Those are great examples as far as who do you guys decide to work with. As far as, you know, my line of work, I focus on IT staffing and development of high-performing teams for IT organizations. So in general, I'm interested in your hiring practices. What do you look for when you bring new advisors on board to Ivy Advisors?
Sure. For our MBA coaches, there's a rule in that you have to have an MBA or you have experience working with MBAs. As an example, most of my team, most of our coaches, they have an MBA degree from a top institution. There's one of them who, she doesn't have an MBA. She went to the School of Education at Columbia, but she worked with the Office of Career Services at Kellogg and at Columbia Business School in helping MBA students find jobs. And she interfaced with them and coached them in their careers. So in that scenario, we do make an exception because she does bring in the experience of working with the MBA. And number two, because we're a coaching organization, we care more about the coaching mindset more than the whatever paper credentials they can bring. So we run through a number of simulations in terms of having a mock case and asking that coach, potential coach, how would you respond to this scenario? And see whether they're good at what they do, at what we expect. A great coach would be somebody who asks a lot of questions instead of imposing a certain recommendation, right? They would probe on the candidate and ask and help that candidate go through a journey of self-discovery. And then kind of lead them, guide them in a certain path that could be optimal or a number of paths and for them to choose. Sometimes we get coaches who are highly opinionated, they have great paper credentials, but they're just jumping into forcing a certain route. That's not necessarily what we look for. So we go through a simulation and we look for that coach mindset that's very pivotal to us At the end of the day, a good coach will provide a great experience to that applicant, and that applicant will put the best of his or her efforts, and therefore will get in.
It's great to hear the use of simulations. It's oftentimes overlooked, but I think it's definitely a powerful tool in terms of preparing for certain situations or really understanding how a particular person will react in a hypothetical situation. So it's very great to hear that you actually utilize tools like that in your organization. Obviously, some of the most rewarding returns for Ivy advisors is when you hear the success stories of your applicants get accepted to the schools of their choice. But what are some of the most challenging aspects of the actual admissions consulting process?
You mean in the process of that applicant or business-wise, like running the organization and stuff? Or do you mean that person going through the admissions process?
Yeah, more curious from a perspective of the applicant, understanding that there's a lot of parts in terms of the test, the application itself, the interviews. From your perspective, what are some of the, the most difficult areas for the applicants as they go through this entire process?
Yeah, the most difficult area, it goes hand in hand. I call it checking your ego with a focus. in a way, everybody brings in a certain ego because they're so proud of whatever they achieved. And some people might not have enough of an ego. We have to boost that. But a lot of people bring in their egos, and we have to check their egos and challenge them. And in a way that makes them focus on exactly what it is, what is the unique aspect of that moment, of that achievement, that makes you so unique. You know, if you talk about consultants, it's very typical for consultants to apply to an MBA program. But consultants, all the time, they are sometimes the youngest person in the room. They are changing business models or proposing models that will revamp a whole business unit and bringing a certain ROI. And that's very common. So we have to really push back and say, that's great, but what about you that enabled it? What is your specific contribution? And they're like, well, I ran an Excel model and I built this. And yes, but every consultant does that. Every consultant goes into Excel and they go into PowerPoint and they go into meetings and they present. So what is it about you that you enable? And then the conversation starts. So the most challenging part is really poking on that ego to the point they can really understand their unique contribution, and then making them focus on it. Because a lot of them come in with like 100 stories and they want to tell them all, and you read it and you're like, what's the point of this whole thing? So that's challenging. And then the second part, preparing for interviews is nerve-wracking. Sometimes we say, hey, getting the interview is key, with the exception of a few schools. They do interview, every single applicant. Some schools are more selective in terms of who gets interviewed. For those, we try to propel whoever it is that was applying. You earn your interview, now go get it. And some people just, there's some paralysis analysis in there. They feel like an imposter syndrome. And we have to help them and coach them and make them feel confident enough and show them, hey, this is you. You earned that interview. You can do this. This is the last step. It's only 30 minutes. But they're very nervous about that.
Mm-hmm. Do you guys have to do a lot of research as far as any, schools that are not the top tier? For example, Harvard, Stanford, I'm pretty sure you guys have pretty good understanding of that application process, but any other smaller schools per se, I guess, do you guys get in extensive research as far as what does that application process look like?
Yeah, totally. We not only research what's out there, there's overwhelming amount of information because of the internet, so we just scavenger hunt for every tip we can. Mm-hmm. But we also have conversations with people, previous clients, their friends, even our personal contacts who might be working at a certain university, to understand that culture, that process, and demystifying it. At the end of the day, you know, admissions is about owning yourself. And people think they have to say whatever the school wants to hear, but most of the time it's owning yourself and being yourself. And yes, there is a component of being focused, but that's only secondary to owning yourself.
Do you guys have plans to expand abroad internationally to help, applicants get into international schools?
Yeah, funny enough, we do have a population of applicants who apply to schools in Europe, like INSEAD, the London Business School, University of Oxford. So we do historically have a population of applicants who do prefer to go abroad. I think, you know, the world is global, so we shouldn't be only tied to U.S. universities.
And as a follow-up, do you guys stay in touch with a lot of your applicants as far as career progression and as they go beyond the graduation? What is the relationship like with your applicants?
Yeah, so, you know, we do keep in touch. And we encourage people to keep in touch with us. Some of them, they just check out. They paid you for that service. They move on. They forget about you. I mean, that's just life in general. And we fully respect that. We're not, you know, harassing them after the work and, like, be my friend. But what's great about our screening process, just because we screen people and we only take clients who are great human beings, most of the time people stay engaged. And we have a LinkedIn group, and we have, you know, not group, a page. And we have a Facebook page, and we have our newsletters, and we have informal ways, you know, Instagram, whatnot. And they most of the time, they stay in touch with their coach, because that's kind of the person who knows them the most. I often joke that whoever runs for president of Congress, I have their dirtiest secrets. So, yes, we do keep in touch. It's a great community. Some of them go to the extent of offering to be volunteers and being a buddy to somebody else in the process. That's how great of an experience they get. They're like, no, we want to help you. How about a buddy system where we are somebody else's buddy? You are still the coach. We just volunteer to, you know, answer any ancillary questions that are pertaining to a student or an alumni. And we really enjoy that. We try to use them. Whoever wants to help, we take that. And it's a great community. I do hope that somebody will run for president and will become president, and somebody will be CEO of a Fortune 500, but we're still waiting for that to happen.
I'm pretty sure it's only a matter of time. Obviously, you read a lot. You do a lot of research. Just curious, what are the top two books, let's say, that you always recommend to those who matter to you, and why?
Sure. The number one book I recommend is How Will You Measure Your Life by Clay Christensen. Not ironically or coincidentally, it's written by Clay Christensen, who is a professor at the Harvard Business School. The book was co-authored by a classmate of mine. You know, he did his research for the book while we were together at the MBA program. His name is James Altshuler. The reason I recommend that book, because you know, when you work with, when you're surrounded in your life and work by a network of overachievers who go to this amazing career route, it's often easy to get lost in the titles and the status and the pay and the size of your house and everything else that is an external factor. And then Professor Clay Christensen does a great job in just making sure we understand, or we have a framework to understand what matters to us and how can we measure that and how do we take steps to be self-aware and not be carried away with this other, you know, measuring sticks of the size of your house, the paycheck, the title, or how famous your company is. So I love that book because of that. In fact, that's the book. After reading that book, I was working at Apple, having my hobby and my passion project, helping MBA applicants. After reading that book, I'm like, you know what? I don't need my job at Apple. That's wow. That's the book that made me quit my job, and therefore I recommend it for everybody else.
That's great.
I take great fulfillment knowing that my work is propelling other people and to do whatever it is that they love and they're great at, and there should be no shame in saying I do not work for Apple, a Google, a Facebook, or whatever it is, you know, an Uber, whatever is the brand of the moment. I own my own company, and if it resonates with people, that's great. If it doesn't, that's great too. At the end of the day, I'm measuring myself by the number of people I help. And because of that impetus that the book causing me, I recommend it for others who are going through, you know, career decisions and whatnot, or life decisions. The second book, the title is more interesting to me. It's called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck. It's written by Mark Manson. It's interesting. It's along the same lines of, you know, how we measure your life, but it's more direct. There's a lot of cussing in the book, but it's more direct. It's like, why do you care so much about what others say? And I am living in Mountain View, California, in the middle of Silicon Valley. And sometimes I have to recommend the book to my friends because you see them getting caught up in this cycle of proving yourself. Or they make a comment, and then once they make a certain comment, they spend 5 minutes making 3 more comments justifying the first comment they make because they can't look back. And I'm like, no, wait a minute. Why did you just do that? Let's move on. And I have to give them that book or recommend that book so that they can really free themselves a little more from whatever external factors are impacting their inner fire, whoever they are. So I love that those two books. It's about you and owning yourself and not asking for permission from the world around you, just taking ownership of that. It speaks to the work that we do. It speaks to who I am and what I advocate for. And I hope other people, more human beings in this world, can, you know, own the messages of these books.
Those are great. Thank you for sharing that. And for listeners, we will have the links to those two books and detailed descriptions posted with the episode notes. Lulu, anything you want to add in closing remarks, something that we perhaps have not touched upon, maybe words of advice with some favorite quotes or anything like that?
Yeah, I was thinking about it. I'm like, huh. And one comment, just because I am a very business-oriented person, one comment I want to make is that when I started this business, there were so many people and well-intended people who were advising me. And this business, Ivy Advisors, could have taken many paths. I consider the nonprofit path because at the end of the day, it's a great cause. And I struggle with the idea of charging people. I thought about some other path, volunteer-based, whatnot. And I ended up making it a full business, a for-profit business. And my closing remark is for people to consider that if you love what you do, you can make it into a business. It doesn't have to be a volunteer thing. It doesn't have to be a nonprofit. You can make a business. And there's something powerful in making a business out of your passion because you're creating jobs. They're giving opportunities to others. My coaches, you know, they wouldn't take a job somewhere else. They just love what they do. You're creating opportunities for others through a sustainable means. Because you're getting a profit, you can fund projects. We can fund our WIV Fellows project because of the profit that we gain. We can give, you know, a deep discount to those who don't have the means to because we have a profit. We don't depend on donations. So my closing message is really for those who are, you know, who are passionate about a certain topic, who have hobbies and whatnot. Don't give up on making your passion project a business. Give it a try. And if everything fails, you can always go back to making it a passion project. But try the business route first because you are creating so much more than just one hobby. You're creating jobs, and those people who take jobs for you from you, they are creating their own respective chains.
That's powerful. Thank you so much, Lulu, for sharing that. And in general, you know, being a guest on our podcast, I definitely look forward to reconnecting with you and staying in touch. And perhaps we could do a follow-up episode in a couple of years to see where you guys are at and all the great success you guys are making, and hopefully have an actual, you know, applicants who have gone to the greater heights. So thank you so much, Lulu. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Jan, and have a great day.
You take care.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.